The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week, the leaking vessel that is the NSC. Following the leak of a National Security Council decision to approve, in principle, Huawei's supply of non-core 5G technology, Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary, has been sacked. But he still denies having anything to do with it. As one despairing official remarked recently, this government is a sieve. We'll be looking at how leak culture seeped into Theresa May's bitterly divided administration. Also this week, Brexit talks are in a critical phase, again, with both sides insisting there's a renewed energy in their efforts to find consensus. Recent polls suggest public support for the Tories has collapsed since the decision to delay Brexit for a second time. And it's not much better for Labour, as party divisions on Brexit have been exposed afresh by the row over the party's European manifesto. Despite all the turbulence, Downing Street has set an informal deadline of the middle of next week for significant progress to be made. So is it beginning to look like an agreement could be found with Labour on a customs union? That's all coming up in this week's Politics Weekly. Now, let's start with Huawei. Last week, the UK's National Security Council, a meeting of senior ministers and intelligence chiefs, agreed in principle to allow Chinese company Huawei to supply non-core technology in future 5G networks in the UK. The decision mysteriously leaked within hours of the meeting, and a whodunit began. And last night, Gavin Williamson, the Defence Secretary, was sacked. He immediately denied, again, that he was the source of the leak and says he was tried by a kangaroo court. We're joined now by Dan Saber, The Guardian's Defence and Security Editor. Dan, is there a precedent for something like this? A cabinet minister is sacked for leaking a decision from the National Security Council?
Certainly not for the National Security Council, from which it is, you know, solemnly said that, you know, the National Security Council is a body in which service chiefs, spy chiefs and politicians mingle and discuss security matters of the day and meets normally on Tuesdays. It's only been around since 2010. There's much is solemnly intoned that there are no leaks from it. Not quite true, but nevertheless.
I can think of a couple.
Yeah, nevertheless, it is a particularly serious cabinet body. No one's been sacked for leaking for 30 years since Leon Britton, so we always sort of dust down the memory books to kind of remember which particular part of the ins and outs of the Westland affair was, and frankly, that was too long ago for anyone to care.
This leak, could it be said that although it's clearly a serious decision, that in fact the idea that a Chinese company might be involved in building parts of Britain's vital national infrastructure could be something that's in the public interest, something that should be discussed in public?
Well, there's an interesting point here. Sometimes the argument is cabinet ministers brief, they never leak. The difference is a bit more than semantic, i.e. if you're opposed to policy or you want to move the policy debate in your direction, then by sort of sharing information selectively, you might be able to nudge the argument your way. Now, what's going on with Huawei? Well, there's arguably an important discussion here about should the technology of a Chinese company, which might be subject to the dictates of the Chinese state, not necessarily always friendly to the UK, should that be allowed in the sort of within supplying the telecom, you know, into the sort of future telecoms network 5G? The Trump administration, or at least some of the security end of it, is very much opposed and has been lobbying very intensively. And some of that lobbying has got through to various cabinet ministers, Gavin Williamson being one of them. But the security establishment in the UK, led by GCHQ, thinks it's okay. The risk can be managed if you put Huawei out there on the edge of the network, antennas, that sort of thing. So there's quite a fierce debate. You know, the big problem about the NSC and the briefing, or really what takes it into a leak on that Tuesday of last week, was that what we learned was that the body was deadlocked. We learned that five cabinet ministers were opposed to it. You know, heavyweight cabinet ministers, Jeremy Hunt, Sajid Javid, you know, Penny Mourners, now the Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, and of course, Gavin Williamson himself. In fact, as kind of emerged subsequently, there are only 10 politicians on the body. So the decision only got through on some kind of prime ministerial casting vote or some such, you know. So the reality was there was a high level split about this issue. And that is what has caused such great conniptions in Downing Street.
And could you say that knowing that there is such a division at the top level of government is in the public interest? Or do you not think that that might have been Gavin Williamson or whoever leaked its motivation?
I think that there was a legitimate debate before the meeting, and I think Gavin Williamson had talked about serious concerns about Huawei and had gone public on it. So in one sense, if he was the leaker, he was being true to that. On the other hand, you know, collective cabinet responsibility is supposed to mean something, and an important decision in principle was taken. And then once that decision is in principle was taken, you're supposed to sort of, you know, hush up and get behind it. And that is clearly was, you know, not the intent of the leaker. The intent of the leaker was to reopen the debate. And that's what happened, because you had this Tory backlash, Tom Tugendhat, Julian Lewis, Bob Seeley, all these sort of backbench Tory MPs coming up and going, we're really worried about Huawei, actually. We think this is a problem, and we think we should be listening to the Americans on this.
How much has May been damaged by this? Has she restored some semblance of trust in her leadership by acting decisively like this?
Can you imagine the scene? She was quite chirpy, some said, at the old liaison committee yesterday. Did she know she was going to fire Gavin Williamson? In she calls him into Downing Street, knowing what she's going to do. What a moment that was. Compelling evidence she had, apparently. Well, now we learn there was an 11-minute phone call between Williamson, made by Williamson, actually, to the journalist of the Daily Telegraph, originally broke the story, the wonderful Steve Swinford. So, you know, what was Williamson's defence? Well, what it appears his defence was, you know, yeah, I was on the, you know, we had the phone call, he asked me about it. I just didn't tell him anything, or didn't tell him anything significant. Well, you've got to decide who you can believe. And in the end, for a prime minister, this is an important reassertion of some sort of authority, although she's really is at the end, you know, theoretically towards the end of her premiership. You know, and it's a trust issue. It's not a court of law here. If the PM doesn't trust one of her key ministers, and clearly she doesn't, they've got to go.
You say it's not a court of law, but obviously Labour and others are calling for a criminal investigation. Even Williamson himself says that one would exonerate him. What do you think the chances are of that, realistically?
I think that's pretty problematic on a whole number of levels. Look, the police don't want it. They remember the Damien Green affair when they were called in to start looking at your leaks coming out of the Home Office, and that really got them to a whole lot of custard with the Tory party at the time. And so the police don't want to do it. If there was a prosecution under the Official Secrets Act, at some point the Attorney General would have to make a decision about a prosecution. I'm pretty sure the Attorney General's had enough fun with Brexit, doesn't want to be taking that decision. And also, you know, we're journalists. We believe in a world of, you know, where there should be some free flow of information and some honest and open debate about ideas and issues. And these are important ideas and issues. And I think if you start getting to criminal investigation, then at some point the cops would have to go around to the office of the Daily Telegraph and start demanding information of a journalist. And journalists shouldn't be revealing their sources, shouldn't be asked revealing their sources, and shouldn't be getting, you know, being drawn into this kind of discussion. We want honest and open and, yeah, it's not always possible to have transparent government, but some sort of open discussion. And in Westminster, some of that requires a certain amount of, let's call it, off-the-record discussion. And you need that flow of information. Otherwise, you don't have good, effective and honest government. So police inquiry, real problem.
Last question. Penny Mordaunt, the new Defence Secretary, what's she bring to it?
Well, look, she's come from a forces background. She's a Royal Navy reservist. She'll have a strong feel for the armed forces. And I think Williamson's relationship with the armed forces was uneasy. He was certainly showing he was willing to lobby for more money and had some, you know, some interesting ideas about how he might sort of construct that debate and new technology. But he was prone to saying some daft things, you know, paintballing Spanish ships as they turned up at Gibraltar's territorial waters. So he was a problematic figure. This is a chance for, you know, a reset. But you also got to remember, Penny Mordaunt was on sort of resignation watch on Brexit not that long ago, was at odds with the Prime Minister on Brexit policy. So she's not someone who, you know, who's been right in the sort of heart of decision, you know, really close to Theresa May at number 10. But she might just be the woman for the moment.
Thanks, Dan. I'm now joined to discuss all this by Stephanie Lloyd from Progress, the Labour pressure group, Henry Newman from the think tank Open Europe, and Jonathan Friedland from The Guardian. Hello, all.
Hi there.
Hello.
Johnny, Westminster's pretty leaky at the moment, and not many people have been sacked for it. Why is this different?
It's different because of the seriousness of it that that the Prime Minister attaches to this body, the NSC. It's talked about as if it's this enduring part of our constitution. It's only 9 years old, but now it's got this sort of hallowed status as being the inner sanctum. It's got to be more secret even than usual. Secrecy. She takes this stuff very seriously. I always think I'm going to make a very frivolous point here, but the side of Theresa May that I think the country quite likes is the sort of Judi Dench M persona, which is the former Home Secretary bit, but also the secret state bit. And that's where she suddenly does look quite capable. And it sort of plays to that. And she, I think, really guards that very jealously. So any violation of that bit of the job, state secrets and the officials, who she's always very, defers to is not quite right, but she goes with their judgment very often. Any violation of that for her, I think, is a sort of taboo. So she takes it very seriously. But the more general point is, you're quite right, that it is a very leaky cabinet, and that is always a morbid symptom of a government that's weak. And so, you know, even in societies other than ours, so you look in America, the Obama administration never, ever leaked. It was the hardest one journalistically for people to cover because it was strong and coherent. Bush administration, Trump administration, massively leaky. So it's a sign of a weak government, and this is a weak government. And I think Theresa May has more or less become accustomed to that. Apparently it infuriates her that the cabinet leaks, but little she can do about that. But this is the kind of holy of holies, and that was a violation too far, it seems, for her.
And do you think that perhaps cabinet ministers might have got used to such a leaky culture that then, you know, perhaps that seeps into places where really that's not acceptable?
I think it's true. I think it's been very apparent for quite a while that there's a huge amount of briefing coming out of all the cabinet committees, including the National Security Council in this case. But I think more generally just cabinet overall on Brexit policy. And a lot of those leaks are trying to position individual cabinet ministers. And it's not that difficult to read the runes. I mean, at one level, I accept exactly what Jonathan was saying, but I think it's also true that most governments have leaked in recent history. We remember the TBGBs back in the 90s and the early Blair government. I mean, I heard one delicious story from a former senior civil servant who recounted an argument with the then cabinet secretary, now going back several decades, and the cabinet secretary exploded about a leak inquiry that had just been ordered by the then prime minister, saying to this friend of mine, civil servant, "We don't know who leaked it yet. Why are we doing the leak inquiry?" And this, of course, is incredibly yes minister moment. I think Penny's promotion is an important moment at one level, which is also the first female defence secretary, which I think is a big deal in of itself. It sort of shows that it's breaking more of those glass ceilings in politics, which is important. But I think also the other side of that is Rory Stewart's promotion into the cabinet. And he'd clearly marked himself out as one of the most effective mid-ranking ministers, but also somebody who was willing to go on telly and the radio and continually defend the prime minister's deal in a very articulate way. And I think she was lacking friends. And I think promoting him, he's got a great backstory as well. He's got a lot of interesting things that he's done, a lot of experience in development and in academia as well. But putting him in as a sort of loyalist on her Brexit plan also made sense for her.
Sounds like you think it could be quite a positive development for the cabinet this reshuffle to have happened.
I think it's difficult having a former senior minister, an ex-chief whip who knows where a lot of bodies were buried, trying to attack you from the backbenches. On the other hand, I think Theresa May is quite a cautious person, so I don't think she would have taken this sort of decision lightly. And there was a little hint of a briefing, I think from the BBC security correspondent yesterday, suggesting that in the course of this leak inquiry, they discovered more things about the former defence secretary than just related to Huawei. And presumably, they felt that they had much more evidence, and the Prime Minister isn't necessarily able to articulate in public exactly how they got all that evidence, but it's not hugely difficult to see how the government would have done so. I mean, when I was in government, we used to work in the Justice Department and the Cabinet Office, and there were various leak inquiries. And I have to say that all the leak inquiries I ever was asked to take part in or watched happening around me, nobody was ever found.
Were people particularly interested in finding the culprit, or was it just
in one
going
case? Yes, because it was in the middle of the Brexit referendum debate, and a letter had been leaked, I think, which splashed the Mail about Circuit offering to back Cameron's position of Remain before Cameron had gone to the February European Council in 2016, and therefore that letter suggested that Cameron had predetermined his position on Brexit. There was a very, very big leak inquiry. The police and the spooks were involved. In the end, it found nobody.
Stephanie, Labour's gone really hard on the idea that this leak is a terrible breach of trust, that the police should be involved, that government ministers should potentially be prosecuted. Why are they doing that? Why are they going down so hard on it?
I don't think it's particularly surprising that they're going down so hard. I mean, I think the thing that is troubling everybody, not just Labour currently, is just how unstable this government is. And in times of such national uncertainty of where we go forwards, I think it is, you know, everybody is seeing just how vital it is that there is a level of coherency. And I think whilst everybody has got utterly used to, although I think that is a very dangerous precedent to have been set in terms of the total abdication of collective responsibility, the constant leakings that come out of government, whilst people have kind of got used to that on the kind of Brexit level, there are certain red lines for people that just feel one step too far. And I think when it comes to anything to do with national security, that is where people will draw that line of you can play politics with everything. You know, I think there is a far too much toleration of everybody playing leadership politics within the Conservative Party with every other issue that is currently really damaging this country. But for that, I think it always feels a little bit of a step too far for people. And I think there is just that ambiguity, and we kind of, you know, have heard it kind of rumbling around of, well, was it breaking the kind of National Secrets Act? And, you know, is this something that is criminal? Is it not? And I think, you know, people are crying out currently for any level of process to actually happen in government at the moment.
The other thing for the opposition, the calculation, is anything which isn't Brexit and that they can talk about without having their tongue tied is handy for them. So this is just classic opposition. This is what all oppositions do. You go hard. This would be no different in the 70s and 80s and Thatcher era. You know, the Westland affair, which Dan mentioned earlier. This is just the meat and drink for opposition.
And also, to be fair, can you imagine how it would be if it was the other way around?
Yeah, of course you'd go hard on it, but it shows government in disarray, incoherence, and it gets to embarrass them, Gavin Williamson. That is a gift that keeps on giving, in the sense that he is just a walking embarrassment. All the video archive of him, the sort of some Tory source called him a complete prat just yesterday, which sort of captures how people see him. And so it's just easy pickings for Labour when you'd much rather not be talking about the difficult stuff, which is customs union.
So I think it's right, but I think that we shouldn't overstate this. I don't think the government is in a complete collapse. I wouldn't agree with Stephanie on the total collapse in collective responsibility, slightly overstating it. I think we've also seen some positioning on the Labour side as well around things like Brexit. I mean, Emily Thornberry is clearly freelancing to quite a strong degree when she's talking about the need for a so-called confirmatory referendum in all circumstances. There are different positions as well around the shadow cabinet table, and we hear about that as well. It's been a particularly leaky few months, and clearly there are a lot of cabinet ministers who really don't like Theresa May and are very willing to mouth off to journalists
and their other colleagues,
and also to promote themselves. But I don't think it's entirely unusual, and I think it's also something that we're seeing in different parties as well.
Johnny, do you think that it's hard to determine what someone's motivation might be, whether it's, you know, purely leadership or whether it's a real concern, but to a certain extent, should this be a decision that's debated in public? Should Williamson have just resigned and said, I wholeheartedly disagree with this decision on Huawei, and that's why I'm going to say that this was a split decision at the highest levels of government, and that's why I'm going to, you know, take this extraordinary step of revealing what happened in the National Security Council? Would he have maintained some credibility by doing that?
I think so. I think that would have been a good move for him. And again, to mention this Westland precedent, the reason we know about that is because Michael Heseltine did in the end walk. It's not a completely disanalogous situation. It's quite a similar situation. It was about a big procurement project. National security was at stake. In that case, it was about buying helicopters rather than a communications network. Interestingly, there was the same fault line then about whether the country should be aligned more with America or less. Prime Minister was on the other side of that discussion then. But he felt this had to be out there, and it was an important decision that needed to be publicly discussed. And in the end, the only way of doing that, he thought, was to resign and famously walk out, physically, literally walk out of the cabinet. There are two principles here which are both important, and they're in collision. On the one hand, you do want the inner councils of government when it comes to matters of national security to have some degree of confidentiality. They couldn't do it otherwise. On the other hand, we, particularly as journalists, want there to be a free, open discussion. How do you get both? Well, you get both by saying, I, Gavin Williamson, need this to be discussed publicly. Obviously, I respect the confidentiality of the inner sanctum of the National Security Council. Therefore, I cannot be on it anymore. That would be the principal way of preserving it. This is, of course, presuming he was the leaker. If he wasn't the leaker, whoever did leak it was trying to have their cake and eat it, really, and trying to keep both of those things. And in the end, you know, something had to give, and I think resignation would have been the more principal course, whoever did the leaking.
I think what was particularly problematic is briefing about the different positions of different cabinet ministers. It's one thing to say the government is having a policy discussion around to what extent should we allow Huawei or other foreign technology into our critical national infrastructure. That discussion has been going since I was in the cabinet office, and I'm sure long before that as well. So it's particularly familiar. But I think it's a different thing to talk about which senior ministers around the National Security Cabinet table were a National Security Council table were opposed to a particular decision.
But it matters, doesn't it, that the Prime Minister was casting vote and against
I think often we hear about votes being taken. The Telegraph wrote a big story about voting, the number of cabinet ministers lined up to vote on a particular issue. And my understanding is that just didn't happen in that cabinet, from speaking to officials who are in the room, that there just wasn't votes. Votes aren't taken in cabinet. The cabinet minutes always begin with the same phrase, which is the cabinet agreed, because by definition, the cabinet agreed, because if you don't agree, you've got to do what Jonathan says and walk out the cabinet, because collective responsibility implies that everybody agrees. So you can vote on whatever you like. It's irrelevant. It's the cabinet is a body that collectively decides things.
Stephanie, where do you think this is going? How much longer do you think this will run in Parliament? Is it something? Obviously, we're getting some urgent questions today from Tom Watson, but beyond that, do you think that this is something that will carry on being a scandal, or will we move sort of back onto Brexit?
I think it depends what happens with Brexit. I think the next big kind of, the minute Brexit kind of feels like it ramps up quite significantly again, I think as always, as it has done for the last couple of years, it will kind of sweep everything aside because it does become so all consuming. But, you know, I think it will continue in the rumblings of, is there much of a government particularly left? Is this a government that's kind of on its last legs? And I think it just becomes another big kind of crunch point in that kind of failure of this government until it kind of collapses at some point soon, which it is certainly what it feels like. I mean, Theresa May's ability to cling on is quite spectacular, but again, it does, you know, it's not with any respect now in the way that it kind of used to feel that people had for her. So I think it will be a kind of big point of it, but I think, yeah, Brexit will sweep it under the carpet as soon as that kicks up a gear again.
So the tiny countervailing point there would be, I agree, we're talking about how well you stand up surrounded by rubble. You know, they're in such a parlous state. That said, I think there's a couple of little minor positives for her out of this. First one is, I do think, headlines across every paper, tabloids included, of her being sacking this guy who sort of seems like a bit of a chump. And that plays, as I say, to the sort of Judi Dench M persona that I think is her strongest suit. The former Home Secretary shtick really plays well for her. And the second thing is, I do think, as you were saying before, it is a good little mini reshuffle for her. Partly because I think Penny Mordaunt would be less likely to resign over some big principled Brexit thing if it means giving up defence rather than giving up international development. I think that's a really plum job for her and she'd be less likely to give it up. Rory Stewart, she's got another Remainer, we're not meant to use that, but a Remainer who is more loyal to her than Gavin Williamson was and is just a more, you know, more of a trooper for her in terms of going on the media airwaves. So I think, you know...
And a much more suitable department for him as well, potentially.
Absolute natural fit for him. So you just, yeah, much, really good fit. And so, you know, considering that the level is low here, working from a very low base, that's a pretty good 24 hours work for her, given that normally it's just carnage everywhere. These are a couple of small positives.
Well, we all look forward to Tuesday afternoons after Cabinet to be completely free of leaks now that new discipline has been restored.
The alternative would be that Downing Street could actually just brief the journalists with what was discussed,
what was
what
actually
used
discussed
to happen,
rather
right?
than
My favourite
line.
One is when the leak is that the Prime Minister was furious about the leaks.
that happens on a fairly regular basis now. Thank you very much, everyone. We'll be back after the break to look at what's been happening with Brexit. Welcome back. This week, Labour's ruling National Executive Committee announced that its manifesto for the European elections would be, quote, fully in line with its long-standing policy on a second referendum. But that falls short of unequivocally backing a referendum on any deal put to Parliament, to the disappointment of Deputy Leader Tom Watson and the Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer. Then at PMQs on Wednesday, in response to a question from Hilary Benn, Theresa May suggested that Labour's customs union policy and the government's policy were quite similar, giving the strongest indication yet that a deal might be achievable. Henry, that's a point you've made a couple of times about the closeness of Labour's position, something that both sides don't necessarily didn't like to be reminded of before, but now might be an asset in these talks.
Yeah, I think we're arguing over a completely artificial dividing line where the Labour Party haven't wanted to say that there already is a customs union, the thing that they're seeking to achieve in the heart of the deal. And the Conservatives haven't wanted to say that either because they want to pretend that the backstop doesn't entail a customs union, at least in the short term. So I think that there's been this profound unreality. It's not just from the front benches, it's from many different groups within Parliament chasing their different ideas. I think one of the most interesting things about the talks have been that the Prime Minister's been able to step up and say, when she does talk about Brexit, that both sides agree with and then list some things, including ending free movement. And I think as long as the Labour Party want to end free movement, then they're talking about a position outside the single market and outside the EU. And therefore, we're arguing over a relatively narrow territory. Are we basically something like Canada or are we something like Turkey? And the Labour Party now run around talking about a strong single market, alignment, obviating the need for checks. That is literally the Chequers policy that they rejected several months back. So we're seeing that nothing is new in Brexit policy under the sun, but ultimately both sides are arguing about relatively small amount of detail. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to find a happy agreement and it'll all they can hold hands and ride off into the sunset. But I do think it means that if you actually look at the substance, we're not arguing about very much.
Johnny, what do you think of the chances are of Labour actually doing a deal? Is there the will there to do it?
So that's why I agree with what we just heard from Henry, that it's not about the actual legal, you know, paragraph this and chapter the other of any agreement. It's the politics of it, of does Labour want to be the co-author of Brexit? And my view had always been that they were happy for Brexit to happen. They just didn't want their fingerprints on it. And that's why I'm always very sceptical of the apparent convergence, because I just don't know why in the end Jeremy Corbyn and the others would agree to take that political hit of being blamed for it if they can get another, if they can see any other way to do it. So I would be still wary. It may be happening, but I would be wary of it simply because what has been the political change that makes them conclude it is better to be fingered as the co-author of Brexit, the sort of midwife of Brexit, than it falling. And the only answer to that might be if they think that the risk of falling is even worse for them because somehow it gets them into a referendum that Corbyn and his team, almost alone in the whole Labour tribe, don't want. And has the politics of that
other than Lem McCluskey?
I include them in that. Sorry. The little group, you're absolutely right to clarify that. The team is Lem McCluskey and the leader's office. And
General Secretary of Unite.
The General Secretary of Unite, whose very close ally is the Chief of Staff of Jeremy Corbyn. It's a group of, you know, it's a handful of individuals. Our former colleague Seamus Milne, it's Lem McCluskey, it's Carrie Murphy, it's Corbyn himself, Andrew Murray. And them against more or less everyone else, the trade union leaders other than Lem McCluskey, the Labour membership, the Labour parliamentary party.
Some Labour MPs, Labour some voters, backbench Labour
MPs. And some backbench Labour MPs who are normally not Corbynites. You know, the Labour Leave cluster of 20, 25 people. Stephanie's the world authority on this. We should hear from her. But until I see that sense in a change on the politics of it, I don't quite know what's in it for them to be, not just to let Brexit happen, they want that, but to be the authors of it.
Stephanie, is there any way ever that Corbyn could ever sell doing a deal with the Tories to deliver Brexit to the Labour membership?
No. I really don't think there is. And he has the ability to sell some truly remarkable things to the current Labour membership. But I just think there is so much. It is the one issue that totally unites so many different parts of the Labour membership currently. And as Jonathan said, you know, all of the trade union leaders, almost and certainly other than Lem McCluskey, almost all
Paul
of Embry, the PLP. But, you know, it is, you know, even if they come to a deal, I cannot see a situation where that gets passed by Labour members of Parliament if it does not have a confirmatory ballot attached to it. And I think this is the thing, is they can, both Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn can want to have these talks and want them to work. But the problem is neither of them really have the ability to lead huge parts of their parliamentary party with them. And it will be the sticking point for both of them. And it will, there is a very, very small and very odd group of kind of people with the kind of hands of power around Jeremy Corbyn that want that to happen. And we saw with the kind of Labour NEC meeting, you know, the general secretaries of Unison, the biggest trade union in the country, of GMB, all coming out saying this is just not an acceptable position to get us to if it does not have a confirmatory deal on it. And obviously we got back to the position of Labour Party policy, which only the Labour Party NEC could take 5.5 hours to get to something of which had already been agreed.
The interesting thing about that NEC meeting was that there were people in that room, people like Tom Watson, some of the trade union leaders, who want Labour's policy to be we will call a referendum on any deal, even a Labour deal. And actually, in the room, 2/3 of the National Executive Committee voted with Corbyn to keep it as a referendum on what they call a damaging Tory Brexit. So not on any deal, which shows he still has the command of the party, right? I mean, that shows that the people are sticking with what his position should be rather than what a lot of the PLP would like it to be.
Well, I think that's true, but I think there is a kind of stretch that can go within that, because there are still large parts of people, there are still a large number of people in that room who don't see any deal as being anything other than damaging. So they can sign off on that wording to try and keep that coalition together. But they know that where, you know, their definition of a damaging deal and, you know, Seamus Milne's definition of a damaging deal are vastly different things still. So there is still that tightrope that they're trying to walk. But there is still a real bit of kind of tension between those two camps.
Isn't it? I think one of the interesting things is that Corbyn's managed to hold this off for now with the NEC meeting. But come September and party conference, there is a much bigger problem looming, which is that presumably party conference will push for a so-called confirmatory ballot in all circumstances. So if Corbyn does want to see, he may not want to be the co-author of Brexit, but if he's happy to see it happening, is there a position...
And he cares about the membership, right? That's one of his big things.
He does care about the membership. So I think it would be very difficult for him to overturn something that was put on as clear policy in a September conference. But might there be a situation where there isn't necessarily a frontbench deal, but some of the backbenchers who do want to see a form of Brexit delivered, even if it's a softer form of Brexit, without a second referendum, might be allowed to have the whip slightly relaxed. And clearly what happened previously is that MPs like Lisa Nandy, who was minded to vote for the government, was told, was strong-armed by Chief Whip and told, or the Shadow Chief Whip, told, do not do this, otherwise you'll be deselected. Might that shift a bit, perhaps? I think the other thing that we're beginning to see is the prospect of a general election is becoming more and more likely. And I think an explicit commitment from the government side that if the withdrawal agreement is passed, there will be a general election before the final ratification of the deal. And that may not be committed to a particular moment, but it means that the Labour Party could go into a future general election promising its own version of Brexit, a softer Brexit, and the Tories could go in promising a different version of Brexit. And the third point, I think, is that although it's not certain, the chances of the extensions being pushed much beyond October are not... It's not definitive that you might be able to get extended beyond October. So October may end up becoming more and more of a hard deadline. In that circumstance, I think your Parliament goes back to its three basic choices. Do you want to revoke Article 50 and stop Brexit, because you wouldn't have time then for a second referendum? Would you want to have no deal, or do you want to have a version of the current deal? And I think that revoke beats no deal, but deal beats revoke. And on that basis, I can imagine that if you actually get to the end of the timetable and October really does look like a hard deadline, which is possible because Macron is persuading other countries that this can't just go on forever, that the gangrenous limb of Britain needs to be at some point sliced off. If that happens, might it be the case that you get to a position where Parliament does actually jump for the deal? Hard to tell.
I want to put a thought experiment to you, Johnny, and to anyone, which a Labour MP put to me earlier this week, which I thought was quite interesting. It was just, can Corbyn get away with actually doing a sort of deal based on the customs union with the government and then saying, we're signing up to this deal, we've now got you this glorious Labour Brexit, but also we expect backbenchers to add a confirmatory referendum to it as an amendment, and we will whip for it, hoping against hope that it doesn't have a majority, which is possible, that it, and it's very likely that it doesn't have a majority. Is that a way that this could work?
And so you mean the Labour front bench itself votes for the confirmatory
vote? Yeah, still thinks there would be enough Labour rebels to not get it through.
Gives a little wink to the Labour rebels saying, you just make sure this dies. I could see them getting away with that. Yes, I agree with Stephanie. It's extraordinary what this leadership does manage to sell to their supposedly reluctant party. I mean, you said before, Jess, that, you know, he's very sensitive and cares a lot about what the party think. Hard to tell from the way...
But that's what he's built his
He's built his brand on it, but it's utterly contradicted, because here is a massively Remain party. You know, the polling only differs whether it's 89% or 95% of members and supporters who are for Remain. And nevertheless, they keep buying this idea that we really want a referendum. It's just we don't mention it on our European election leaflets. We don't mention it on the letter we send to the Prime Minister. We just keep forgetting it. And amazingly, the party... so innocently keep saying, oh, okay, well, we all have, you know, memory lapses every now and again. It's very natural. So I could see him getting away with that, actually. It's not what the party want. They don't want any Brexit. Nevertheless, if he said, I've got this one, but you're going to get your referendum, oh, look, you know, what a shame. John Mann and Caroline Flint have voted it down. Well, never mind.
So we'll just have to leave the European Union.
I could see them getting away with
this. Well, I was just going to say, and the one thing that they would then happily quite do on that is go, look at these people who stopped your referendum.
Then they get the blame of the members.
Now you can go and deselect them. And these are people that they would quite happily get rid of anyway. So
the Labour leavers.
I've got a horrible feeling that you might have just given them a way out of this, Jess. I'm not quite sure I'm happy about that.
But isn't there another side of this as well, which is that if you were, I think... if this happens and there is a some sort of front bench arrangement on the customs union, that is going to be very hard for the Tory party.
Absolutely.
And I think this is, if you're a sort of Labour strategist watching the kind of Tory party tearing itself apart over a customs union question, which I think is overstated anyway, but that's irrelevant. Some MPs will really, really care about this. Tory party probably losing its majority then to operate beyond the passage of the deal. I think Corbyn's position could end up being vindicated, right? If that then triggers a general election because the government's collapsed. I mean, it's a question then is, does, and this is a big strategic question for Labour, do they want Brexit or do they want to stop Brexit more than they want to stop a Tory government? And I suspect that the view is they'd rather have a chance to hold power, first of all. And if passing the Brexit deal with the customs union means that you destabilise the Tory party so much that you create a sort of essentially an existential crisis for them, is that a path, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, that idea that actually both parties will be relying on others to vote it down. And this is in 27-dimensional chess. But it's quite true that you could have customs union being accepted by Labour but rejected by Tories, and in the end they don't have to do it. In answer to your question, though, what's more important to them, stopping Brexit or stopping this government? That is very, very clear. They want to stop this government. They're not that bothered, the leadership, the little group around the leader, about stopping Brexit. They quite want that to go through. Their dream scenario is Brexit is done by this government. It's out the way. And in the act of doing it, the government breaks itself up. And Labour could come in and inherit with all the hard work already done. I think that's their ideal.
Although the one thing I would say is the idea that once that withdrawal agreement is passed, Brexit is done, is the fallacy for
any
government that's going to go through.
So we're going to be here.
They're then just going to have to clean up the rest of the mess that comes afterwards and all of the promises won't ever be deliverable.
Thanks very much, all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Henry Newman from Open Europe, Stephanie Lloyd from Progress, Dan Sabber and Jonathan Friedland. The producer was David O'Donnell. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.